Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
All of a sudden, there's lots of noise about the so-called quiet beetle. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today on the show, a closer look at the life and influence of the late George Harrison. And later, live music in our studio from the Balkan-flavored group A Hawk and a Hacksaw. We start, though, with another installment of our mini-series that we're calling Beatles 2K11. The story of the Fab Four is well-documented, but is being told this year from some different angles. Yesterday we heard about Paul McCartney's score for the New York City Ballet. Tomorrow we'll ask a John Lennon biographer about contemporary musicians who are carrying on that Beatles legacy. Today, we're all about George. In a moment, we'll talk with a music critic and open the phones, but there's a reason that George Harrison is in the ether right now. He's the subject of an upcoming HBO documentary called Living in the Material World. New York Times culture reporter Dave Itzkoff wrote about it and joins us on the line from L.A. to tell us all about it. Dave, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you so much for having me.
Considering how much we've already seen and heard about the four Beatles over the years, the anthology project, exhaustive biographies, what is there still to tell us about George Harrison?
Well, I think there are two interesting propositions about this new documentary. One, of course, is that a lot of the material is supplied by George himself. It's all, or a lot of it, is archival footage that he himself filmed or gathered over the years while he was still alive and was accumulating at Friar Park, and that his widow, Olivia Harrison, sort of was entrusted and became the diplomat for to turn this into a film. The other part of that equation is Martin Scorsese, who is the director of the documentary and who we know not only from, you know, his movies like The Departed or Goodfellas, but from his music documentaries
right. Like
The Last Waltz and Shine a Light. So when you, I think, combine those two halves of the equation, it immediately becomes a pretty tantalizing proposition.
So Olivia Harrison, George's widow, has all this stuff there at Friar Park, the vast estate that George owned.
Right.
And has just been kind of sitting on it for all these years, waiting for the right filmmaker to come along? Is that the impression you got?
Well, I spoke to Olivia for the article that I wrote, and I think that, you know, she has a really interesting relationship with her, legacy as the wife of a Beatle. And, of course, you know, she wants to fulfill George's wishes, who, when he was alive, she said, talked a lot about wanting to sort of do his own anthology. And so in that sense, she feels like she's kind of carrying forward his desires. But these are all very personal items to her that are utilized in the film, whether it's the footage of him, letters that he wrote, things that he recorded on tape, or even entire suitcases that he would pack from trips and then not unpack when he came home. So I think for her it was a process of not only finding a director that she felt would sort of best represent the story, but just getting herself comfortable with having to share these things with the wider world, even for a little while.
Dave Itzkoff's article for The Times about the George Harrison documentary can be found on the Soundcheck page of our website, by the way, wnyc.org/soundcheck. I do like the idea of George having, you know, he comes back from a trip and he doesn't bother to unpack the suitcase, just leaves it as a kind of what? A time capsule, I guess.
Exactly. I think that's only a few people could sort of live their lives that way, and he certainly sounds like one of them, yeah.
All right, so tell me how this thing plays out. It's in 3 hours over two parts, basically.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah, HBO is going to be broadcasting it, I believe, October 5th and 6th, and as it was presented to me, I think this is how they're going to broadcast it. The first half of it, about the first 2 hours, is still very Beatles-centric, although
yeah.
It's told, you know, from George's perspective and his experience coming up through the Beatles, and it's interviews, of course, with Ringo and with Paul and with, Astrid Kircher and a lot of people that, we think about from the history of the band going back to the Hamburg days. And then the second half is right when when the Beatles have broken up, and then it becomes really the story of George's life after the band, and certainly things get very interesting then in his solo career with the Traveling Wilburys, and just him sort of coming into his own as a person and a very spiritual one.
And that seems to be, the big arc of the life of George Harrison, is George coming out of the shadow of Lennon and McCartney and kind of blossoming into a songwriter and a person, a public person, a private person on his own. In the first part of this Beatles documentary called this George Harrison documentary called Living in the Material World, there's a moment where you hear from the Beatles' famed producer, George Martin, and then from George Harrison himself.
John and Paul had each other to play against, and their collaboration was much more of a competition than a collaboration, really. One would do something and the other one would say, gosh, I think I can do better than that, and try and make something better. George was the sole guy. He had no one to work with.
The funny position I was in was that in many ways, this whole focus of attention was on the Beatles. So in that respect, I was part of it. But from being in them, an attitude came over, which was John and Paul. Okay, were the grooves, and you two, just watch it. I mean, don't forget, I spent 10 years in the back of a limousine with them.
That is George Martin, followed by George Harrison, from the new documentary by Martin Scorsese called Living in the Material World, being broadcast next week in two parts, Wednesday and Thursday night, on HBO. David Itzkoff is culture reporter of the New York Times with us on the line from L.A. Who did they talk to besides, obviously, George Harrison, archival stuff, George Martin? I mean, we see a lot of Paul McCartney and Eric Clapton, right?
Well, Clapton, of course, you can imagine, figures very prominently in the story as well. And, of course, because it's a Martin Scorsese film, you're going to get the unpacking of the story behind Layla. But of course, also, the friendship and the really close creative collaboration that Harrison and Clapton enjoyed over many years, in spite of, the role that Patty Boyd might have played between the two of them. Mm-hmm. There's also some really terrific conversations with Tom Petty, who worked with Harrison in the Traveling Wilburys, and really thought of Harrison as his big brother, and really saw, I think, a very humorous man in George, and really did not regard him as in any way as the kind of the stereotype of the sitar playing mystic that he's sometimes caricatured as.
Well, but clearly the guy had a sense of humor. He teamed up with Eric Idle of Monty Python fame to form Handmaid films, and
he helped. I mean, he essentially helped rescue the Monty Python movies when they were having trouble, with Life of Brian, and was really there for, I think just was such a Monty Python fan that he just wanted to make sure that movie got made, even if he had to pay for it himself.
Now, you mentioned unpacking the Patty Boyd affair. Does Scorsese really kind of lay that, this Patty Boyd being a woman who was romantically involved with both Eric Clapton and George Harrison, she is the subject of Layla. I mean, is he able to kind of unpack that story fully with Olivia Harrison, George's widow, kind of hovering over his shoulder as kind of an executive producer of this?
I see what you're saying, and the remarkable thing is that I don't think that Olivia really was making those kinds of demands on the project. I think she understood that when you especially when you recruit somebody like Scorsese to do a project like this, that you can't invite him in and then ask for final cut over something like this. And I just again in my own conversations with Olivia, I mean, I get the sense that she really was at peace with all of George's history, including the part of his life that preceded her, but also understood with a movie like this that it's not going to be an encomium to George, that it really has to be the entirety of his life, and that includes things that don't always portray him in the most beatific light.
Right. We're speaking with David Itzkoff again. Has written this story called Within Him, Without Him. You can find it on linked on our page, wnyc.org/soundcheck. It's about this George Harrison documentary that's being shown on HBO. The documentary is called Living in the Material World. We hear a lot from Paul McCartney talking about George during the course of the documentary. And Paul suggests that they all, in the Beatles, they all knew something big was eventually coming from George.
We didn't underestimate George. We knew that he was peaking, you know, as we got to those records. He'd not been really interested in the beginning, I don't think. And because John and I did so much of the writing, he could just leave it to us. But I think he realized, you know, that there was something in this, that artistically and financially, it was a good thing to get into. So by that time, we realized that he was really coming up with the goods.
Paul McCartney remembering George Harrison in the forthcoming documentary called Living in the Material World. Two nights, 3 hours, Wednesday and Thursday on HBO. Dave, what's your impression? Is it worth 3 hours of our time?
Well, you know, I saw it in one sitting at an HBO screening room, and the time really just flew by. It certainly did not feel like a 3.5 hour experience. I think for, you know, people that are interested in Beatles music or in Harrison are really going to get a tremendous amount out of it.
All right, Dave, thanks very much for reporting on this for us.
My pleasure.
Dave Itzkopf's been on the line with us from L.A. He is cultural reporter for The New York Times. And in the documentary, Paul McCartney notes that even though he wrote the song And I Love Her, the famous guitar riff was all George, and it really made the song. Up next, we continue our look at the quiet Beatle, the late George Harrison, with your calls and comments. And then coming up later, a hawk and a hacksaw. They're based in Albuquerque, New Mexico, but they look to Hungary, Romania, and the Balkans for musical inspiration. They will play live. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. More now in our look at George Harrison. We just heard about the new documentary that chronicles the life and career of the so-called Quiet Beatle and his rise as a songwriter, solo artist, a spiritual person. Now, in that age-old, loosely regulated contest known as Who's Your Favorite Beatle, John and Paul tend to be the favorites. Ringo has his fans, but George does too, and appreciation of his talent has only grown since Harrison died in 2001. We want to know, what do you think of George Harrison? Favorite Beatle? How do you rate his songwriting? How do you rate his solo career? There are some who think he had the most successful solo career of the four ex-Beatles. Give us a call, 212-433-WNYC. That's 433-9692. Or leave a comment on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. Joining us in our studio is Jim Fusilli, rock and pop critic for The Wall Street Journal. Jim, welcome back.
Hey, John.
So this documentary is a kind of exploration of George that we've seen this sort of thing before, but, you know, is it time to take another look at George Harrison?
You know, it may be time. You know, he's unknown to us in so many ways. I don't know if he was personally a quiet Beatle, but he seemed, in all that sort of hubbub, the mega celebrity of it, to be kind of lost in it. And I think he was wonderful at things that are kind of under the radar.
I wonder if he seemed lost or if he just seemed apart, you know, like he was in the eye of the storm and sort of not buffeted as much as the other three might have been by all the stuff that was going on.
You know, he was so young. He was younger than the others.
Right.
You know, he may have had the wisdom to make that decision at a very early age, or it may just have been circumstance where the three older guys kind of stood in front of him.
Now, if I ask you, Jim, who your favorite Beatle is, I'm putting you on the spot here, but well, let me just ask, who's your favorite Beatle?
Well, in all the years that we follow them, it's changed a number of times. But, I mean, it's currently Paul because I just think his body of work is so strong and his, just the way he plays and seeing him play the last few years and how much responsibility he continues to take on himself at this late stage. But I think all four of them are really terrific in their own ways. And so amazingly complementary to each other.
And in terms of, you know, most people, when you ask this question, you get lots of Pauls, you get lots of Johns. There is a little bit of kind of rooting for the underdog when it comes to George and Ringo, isn't there?
Agreed. And you know, that was the one of the most wonderful things about All Things Must Pass. If you had an affection for George and then you put that album on, you just said, ah.
Well, a lot of people sort of developed that affection for George in the early 70s. He had a string of solo records at a time where the other guys seemed to be kind of casting about to find their path. And he's coming up with, as you say, All Things Must Pass and Living in the Material World, Dark Horse. We asked our listeners on Facebook if George was their favorite Beatle, and Catherine wrote, "He never used to be. John was always my guy. But George's combination of creative curiosity and iron hand in velvet glove manner, oh, and his knack for writing tuneful melodies, has made him a big favorite." Peter writes, "His solo stuff is all over the place, but I'll take it over Lennon's." And Michael Azarad, the critic and musician, writes, "George was not my favorite Beatle, but I'll come right out and say it. All Things Must Pass is one of the greatest rock albums ever made."
Let me into your heart. Let me know you. Let me show you.
George Harrison, from the album All Things Must Pass, 1970, that's I'd Have You Anytime. Jim Fusilli, this particular track was your pick. Why?
It's just gorgeous. I mean, what a vocal, what an arrangement, just the pace and tempo it's taken at. And the amazing thing is that fantastic album with so many big, large numbers, this is the opening track. Mm-hmm. And George is directly addressing us. You know, come on in.
So after the Beatles broke up, what do you think about his solo stuff? I mean, did he kind of hit a high note maybe a little sooner than the other guys, or did we just not hear that high note for a few years until looking back we thought, hey, this guy really had something?
Yeah, I actually never met George, so I just put that caveat there. But I think, you know, once George did All Things Must Pass, he had sort of done it. You know, he had been in the greatest band ever, and now he had made perhaps the greatest album among the solo works of the greatest band ever. And he had other interests and pursued them.
Those interests were spiritual interests. There was this sort of comic side. You know, we talked before with Dave Itzkoff about handmade films with Eric Idle and helping to produce the Monty Python movies and stuff. And then, of course, there was the kind of humanitarian interest. And the Concert for Bangladesh, I mean, that remains sort of the model, the template for a lot of the Band Aid and Farm Aid and all Live Aid and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and with nothing to precede it. I mean, you know, they did it right musically, and eventually they got the money into the right hands.
1971, the concert took place, and the concert was recorded and released as Concert for Bangladesh.
Told me that he wanted help for his country. All of you to help us save some lives.
That is George Harrison and the song Bangladesh from the famed Concert for Bangladesh of 1971. We're looking back at the life and career and music of George Harrison, the subject of the Martin Scorsese documentary that airs next week. We're speaking with Jim Fusilli, the rock and pop music critic for the Wall Street Journal, and with our Soundcheck listeners on the line with us at 212-433-WNYC. Hannah is with us from Riverdale. Hannah, what do you think of George Harrison?
George has been my favorite Beatle since I was in my early 20s. And when I met my husband on our first date, we both discovered that While My Guitar Gently Weeps was our favorite song in the world. And on our second date, he brought me, he'd made a CD with all George Harrison from the Beatles songs on it, which is something I'd always wanted, and we're living happily ever after. So George has played a big role in my life.
All right, Hannah, thanks very much. Let's move on to Alex, who's with us in New Jersey. Alex, what's your George Harrison story?
Well, you know, growing up in Uruguay, my family had the Beatles drawing big, huge in the garage, and I associated myself with Ringo because I liked drums. But as I grew up and I, you know, lived in a monastery and that sort of thing, I became more of a contemplative and I began to slowly identify myself with George Harrison. And then I guess what sealed the whole thing was when I first met my wife. It took me about a year to give her the first kiss. And one of the catalysts was that I sang to her in the car, and I love her. And I couldn't remember the words, but I did the guitar part really well, I guess. And so that song became our wedding, a reception music. And ever since then, you know, George Harrison is, it's the guy.
Wow. Well, as we learn in the Martin Scorsese documentary, that it's the guitar part of And I Love Her that George came up with. It's otherwise a Paul song. So Alex got the important part right there. Took him a year in a monastery to work up the nerve, but he got the important part right. It does seem, Jim, I mean, just from my own point of view, I sort of realized how good those George Harrison, those early records were in retrospect. I mean, it was way, way after the fact. And that seems to not be such an uncommon occurrence.
No, I think George has both professional and personal traits that are not so apparent when you're young. I mean, you know, George was diligent and professional when he was young. He was the guy that tuned the instruments for the members of the band. Now, that's not very sexy. When you're a kid, you don't really admire that so much. But the older you get, the fact that he was completely reliable was great. And the fact that he was, you know, I mean, the musical directorship of the Beatles shifted quite a lot. But he was really kind of running things during Revolver and Rubber Soul. Hmm. I mean, he was introducing American folk rock to the other guys and really insisting on the greatness of Dylan, particularly to John, and it influenced John's work a lot. Now, these are the kind of things that don't really land on you when you're young. But as you get older and you know how success happens, you understand that you need somebody like George Harrison to make it work.
Now, it wasn't all, you know, a kind of rocket ascent for George Harrison. I mean, he had those albums in the 70s, which we now look on as great records. In fact, Dark Horse didn't get such great reviews in the day. And then... the guy was sort of in need of a comeback in the mid-80s, and he comes back with this album called Cloud Nine. Where was he? Where are we in the arc of George's story here?
Well, I think Cloud Nine is the beginning of the third act, particularly since he died so young. I certainly believe that he was capable of making better music than he did between the Dark Horse and Cloud Nine periods. I think in Dark Horse, with his throat problems and just sort of the emotional investment that really didn't pay off for him, probably...
This is the Patty Boyd story.
I think, you know, more about getting that out of his system and then getting back on the road and being unable to sing and get the music across and people still resisting his Indian influence in his music. Mm-hmm. I think he thought, you know, why put up with this? But then, as you say, Cloud Nine, really strong. And then things that came after that, really strong too.
And Cloud Nine sort of riding on the waves of a number one hit, his version of an obscure Rudy Clark song called Got My Mind Set on You.
I got my mind set on you. Got my mind set on you. But it's gonna take money. A whole lot of spending money. It's gonna
That is George Harrison's number one hit from 1987, Got My Mind Set on You, from the comeback album called Cloud Nine. We're remembering George Harrison, his life and his work, with calls and comments. We've heard some calls, no comments yet. So let's go into the control room where producer Joel Meyer has some. Joel?
John, we have some really nice comments on the soundcheck page at wnyc.org/soundcheck. Susie from the Bronx writes this: on a totally superficial level, in his youth, George was most definitely the hunkiest of the Fab Four. Nick from the Upper West Side writes, you have to listen to George's solo work and his solo songs to recognize what he added to the Beatles. Guy Mysterioso from Bed-Stuy is not so sure. He writes, George was an amazing songwriter, one who grew close to the heights of John and Paul. Close, but not quite there. And then we got a really interesting call from a listener named Albert. You know, John, we're doing this series this week about the Beatles in 2011. Mm-hmm. Albert's tired of hearing about the Beatles. John, we've been hearing about Beatles Rock Band and the Beatles on iTunes. He wants to know why we're still talking about them. Maybe Jim Fusilli can answer that.
Yeah, Jim, I mean, this is a story that gets, it seems like we're telling it every year. There's another edition of the Beatles story to tell.
Yeah, and I think the thing that doesn't make it completely overbearing is that you can just wash all that stuff away and listen to the music. I mean, the thing about the Beatles, and I, you know, I've actually talked about this with Ringo, is that the body of work is there. And yes, I mean, you know, the big machine constantly churns up the waters and makes us pay attention again. But, you know, that'll eventually all go away. And all that will be left is the music. And it speaks to us, and it is the greatest body of work by any rock band.
Well, now, we talked yesterday about Paul, because he has the new ballet. Tomorrow, Tim Riley's done this big new biography of John Lennon. We'll talk about who the contemporary musicians are who are continuing that legacy. Today, we're talking about George. Where's Ringo in all this? Why is there no Ringo thing happening right now?
Well, I think part of it has to do with the instrument that he plays. You know, he's a drummer. He sits in the back. He kind of lords over things and observes from that position. I also think it's his public personality. Ringo's a very self-effacing guy. He would never insist that you pay attention to him. Mm. He leads with humor and dry wit. I think Ringo's had a wonderful and very happy life. And whenever I speak to him, I walk away thinking, yeah, he had a good time, didn't he?
Jim Fusilli is the pop and rock music critic for the Wall Street Journal and has been with us on Soundcheck. I'm going to give the last word to Janet, who is calling in from Greenwich, Connecticut. Hey, Janet.
Hi. I have to tell you, this is quite remarkable for me because I have a son who recently got married, and he is a brilliant, multi-talented, and a drummer, by the way, about from the age of two. And he and I, to this day, talk about George. And he knows that George was always my favorite. And he has put together a string of CDs with high moments of George's music. And just recently, I have All Things Must Pass in my car. And just for the past month or so, just not even thinking that there's this hullabaloo about George, it's been in my car and I listen to it at the highest volume. My Sweet Lord, I cannot listen to it enough. And when he was the only Beatle who had a mystery about him from the very beginning. His slight shuffle was as far as he went, and that was even too much for me.
Well, he was the spiritual Beatle, the quiet Beatle, the third Beatle. I mean, call him what you want. He was George Harrison. He is very much in the airwaves these days, the HBO documentary being aired on Wednesday and Thursday of next week. And to everyone who called in, thank you. Check out the comments on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. Still to come, A Hawk and a Hacksaw. The band joins us in studio for a live performance next.